Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Illiteracy Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Benson, a senior policy analyst at the Heartland Institute, a national free market think tank. We're in episode 130-something territory. I'm not exactly sure what episode number. Never usually know. But point being, we're not a very new podcast anymore. But for those of you just tuning in for the first time, basically what we do here on the podcast is I invite an author on to discuss a book of theirs that's been newly published or recently published on something or someone or some idea or some event, et cetera, that I think you would like to hear a conversation about. And then hopefully at the end of the podcast, you'll go out and give the book a purchase yourself and give it a read. So if you like this podcast, please consider giving Illiteracy a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show. And also by sharing with your friends, as that's the best way to support programming like this. And my guest today is Mr. Ian Baruma. And Mr. Baruma is the Paul W. Williams Professor of Human Rights and Journalism at Bard College. And in previous lives, he was also cultural editor of the Far Eastern Economic Review, foreign editor of The Spectator, and editor of the New York Review of Books. He is also a regular contributor to the New York Times Magazine, The New Republic, The New Yorker, and The Guardian. And he is the author of, among others, Theater of Cruelty, Art, Film, and the Shadows of War, Murder in Amsterdam, The Death of Theo van Gogh and the Limits of Tolerance, Year Zero, A History of 1945, The Churchill Complex, The Rise and Fall of the Special Relationship and the End of the Anglo-American Order, and A Tokyo Romance, A Memoir. And lastly, he is the author of The Collaborators, Three Stories of Deception and Survival in World War II, which was published last March by Penguin Press and is the book we will be discussing today. So, Mr. Baruma, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I do appreciate it.
Thank you. Just one correction. The last one is actually Spinoza.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about I was going to ask you about Spinoza because I actually wanted to talk to you about Spinoza for the podcast. Yeah, but it was supposed to be delivered from Amazon like a week ago, and then I got an update that it wasn't going to be here until the 28th. So I never had a chance to read it.
Yeah, there's a problem with Amazon. Other people have told me that.
Yeah, it's been weird. It seems like every other order I've had from Amazon lately is being delayed. And not just by like a day or two, but like a week. Yeah. So anyway, so I apologize. I did want to talk to you about Spinoza because I'm a big fan of the Jewish Live series, which is from Yale University Press. That's the Spinoza book is one of the latest entry in the Jewish Live series. So actually, before we get to what we were talking about now, why don't you just tell everybody about, just give everybody a little rundown of the Spinoza book so they can look out for that one.
Well, I mean, Spinoza interested me not just because the 17th century in the Dutch Republic is interesting, but because I think we need him more than ever, because he was really the philosopher of freedom of thought and freedom of speech. And in his day, which, as I said, was in the mid-17th century, the main opponents of free speech, as he saw it, were religious. So he got banished from his synagogue in Amsterdam at a very young age. He was only 23. For disbelieving in the idea that there is such a thing as God, a creator. He thought God was inherent in nature, that nature is really God. Mm-hmm. He also disbelieved miracles and angels and the immortality of the soul. And the Jewish rabbis had to be very careful not to annoy the Christians. So they were irritated enough by this, what they saw as blasphemy, but they also didn't want to get into trouble with the Christians, who were dominant, of course. And so Spinoza got kicked out. But after that, the main opponents of free speech were really the Calvinists, the Orthodox Calvinists. And there is a parallel with our own time in that the fight over free speech was not only political or religious, but was also very much part of the academy, of the universities at the time. And the Calvinists, the religious professors, felt that the way to the truth was through the Bible and the Word of God, And Spinoza's idea of finding the truth was closer to our idea of science. And that was the use of reason and so on. And the religious professors, of course, saw that as a direct challenge to their authority. And so the reason I was interested in Spinoza is because I think we're struggling with something similar today. I mean, not only are there still many religious people who feel that certain books need to be banned because they supposedly offend moral sensibilities of religious people, but also there are secular versions, especially in the universities, museums, publishing houses, and so on, where dogmatic views on race, on gender, and so on are being imposed, and freedom of speech is again, freedom of thought is again under pressure from both the right and the left. Spinoza, I think, has a lot to tell us.
Did you get a chance to read, who is it? I think Jonathan Israel, didn't he have doorstop
a book
last year?
More than 1,000 pages.
Yeah.
I've read big chunks of it, yes. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to read the whole thing in one go. But
sure, of course. No, your biography is not quite that large.
No.
The Jewish Life series are... Those are books that you can read in, you know, one setting or two setting. They're meant to be brief biographies, but they're fantastic. Like I said, you can't really see on camera, but right over here, I got a whole shelf of them. I think I have practically every one.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to that one. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to read it beforehand, but we'll have to blame Jeff Bezos for that because he bricked on the delivery. So unfortunately, nothing we can do about that. Now on to the collaborators. Or actually, before we get to that, one thing. I know in your background, or you studied Japanese cinema, correct?
Yes, I did. I first studied Chinese literature and history, and then I went to Tokyo on a scholarship and studied Japanese cinema over there. Yeah.
Yeah. So. My son, who will turn 4 tomorrow. Hi, Robbie. Happy birthday. He's in his dinosaur phase, you know, like most kids have like a dinosaur phase. So like 6 months ago, we were just sort of lounging before we were getting ready for bed. And I was just going through and I saw on HBO Max that they had all the old Toho Godzilla films from the 50s and 60s and 70s. So I put on the original Godzilla movie for him. And I was like, well, let me just see how this is going to go. Probably not going to work because it's in black and white. It's entirely in Japanese. So he can't understand a word anything anybody's saying. But he loved it. And now he is like a giant Godzilla freak. Like he is... We have watched practically all those old Toho Japanese films. He doesn't like the new Godzillas very much, the American ones, but like the old ones, he absolutely adores them. And now I have, I've gotten him like Godzilla figures. So like Godzilla and Mechagodzilla and Mothra and Rodan and Gigan and Gyrus and King Ghidorah and all these other things. And he plays with them all the time. And, so I probably now know more than like 99% of humanity about Godzilla movies, which mm-hmm. was something I never, just some like just from having to watch these movies all the time. And it was something I never thought would happen in my life. And it's just amazing how kids just get attached to something. And now I'm like, well, you know, who knows? Maybe my son's going to be, one of those kids that's like massively interested in like Japanese culture, and I'm going to have to like take him to Japan in a couple of years or something like that. All because I turned on a Godzilla movie when he was 3 and a half. Strange how that kind of stuff happens.
Mm.
Yeah. Have you watched one more thing? Have you watched that Tokyo Vice show at all on HBO?
I haven't. No.
No, you haven't? Oh, I just started it. It's pretty good. So I don't know how realistic it is. I mean, it deals with like Yakuza and all that stuff and police and everything, but pretty well done, I got to say, for the HBO stuff. So if you ever get some spare time, check it out.
Right.
All right. Anyway. All right. So to the book itself, The Collaborators. So what made you want to write this book? What was the genesis of it? Because it never would have occurred to me to write about these three people. First of all, because I didn't know who any of them were. And I know, I mean, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but, you know, I pay attention to a lot of the World War II stuff. And I just, if I had heard of any of these three people, it had only been in passing. And like I said, so it's something that never would occur to me to write about. How did you fix on this idea for this book and what you explore in it and on these three individuals that you feature?
Well, I think there are various things. One is that I was born in December 1951, so I obviously was not alive during the war. But I did grow up in the shadow of the war, and especially if you grow up in a country like the Netherlands, where I grew up, which had been under Nazi occupation, you couldn't avoid it. And when I was a school kid, the narrative was almost like a myth. I mean, it was very clearly divided between heroes and villains. Mm-hmm. And all one's teachers, of course, had been resistance heroes, and you didn't go and shop in a certain candy store because the lady working there apparently had an affair with a German soldier and so on. So we had a very clear division in who the heroes were and who the villains. And only gradually did it occur to us, sort of some decades after the war, really, that there were a lot of gray areas and people collaborated for all kinds of reasons and so on. And not everybody was such a clear-cut hero or a villain. And in fact, most people had tried to survive as best they could by keeping their heads down.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got more and more interested, really, in the gray areas. And also because I feel that very few of us are likely to be great heroes in a crisis, because few people are.
We all think we will be, but
well, we might have, but to think that is already rather an assumption.
Right. Right.
Very few of us probably would be out and out villainous collaborators either. I think in most countries under Nazi rule, but I think that probably goes for most dictatorships, a fairly small number of people are brave enough to resist, and a relatively small number of people are out and out villains. Most people, again, try to survive. So I was interested in that. And at least two of these characters were well known to me. One was a Hasidic Jewish immigrant in Holland who came over after World War I as a child, and was one of these people who thought he was smarter than everybody else. And he was a con man, really. And during World War II, his con was that he promised fellow Jews under Nazi occupation who were in danger of being deported to death camps that he had this list that was backed by the German army. And if you paid him money, you could be on the list and then be taken to safety in Switzerland or Portugal or Spain. So that's the con man. Then the other person who was well known to me, because she's again a sort of legendary figure in Japan and in China to some extent, was a Chinese or Manchu princess. And she collaborated with the Japanese, had affairs with Japanese generals and so on, and was executed after the war by the Chinese as a traitor. And then the third one, again, a well-known figure in certain circles. There's even a movie apparently in the make with Woody Harrelson playing him, was Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, his personal masseur, who was a Finn and was not an out-and-out collaborator, but he made Himmler's life more comfortable as he murdered millions of people. And so I put the three together not because they had a great deal in common, but they all, of course, tell a certain part of the history of World War II, but also, and this is where I think, again, where there are echoes today, that what happens under dictatorships or military occupation is the truth is the first thing that disappears, because everything is propaganda. And these are great periods for fantasists, people who make up the truth, often opportunistically, because they can reinvent themselves and become collaborators with the dictators or authoritarian rulers or foreign occupiers, and play roles that in normal life in more open societies would be completely impossible. And again, I don't need to stress the contemporary echoes in which, again, we live with politicians who are in many respects fantasists, and so are their followers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Back on the issue of collaboration, and you write in the book probably paraphrasing, but there's, a thousand reasons for resistance, just as there are a thousand reasons for collaboration. And it's hard, as you said, it's hard to say what we would do when faced in that, put in the pressure of that situation. There's so many different factors, whether you have a family to worry about or children or where you are geographically, et cetera, et cetera. So you try not to judge people based on their actions, because you just don't know, again, what you would do in the situations. But it seems to me, of the three, Weinreb, who was an active collaborator, because there's degree of collaborations too. I mean, as you said, most people just sort of, carried on and tried to keep their heads down and stuff. So maybe for the most people, there was some sort of soft collaboration or just, going along to getting along, that sort of thing. But Weinreb seemed to be, contemptible in that he actively collaborated, was what the Germans call, was it Vertrauensmann?
Yes.
A V-man or a trusted person.
Yeah.
So he actively betrayed other people. He actively betrayed his fellow Jews to save
himself. Well, that's in some ways what was the most contemptible. I mean, that he himself, of course, was in constant danger of being deported to a death camp. But then to con other people who are in the same boat is particularly contemptible. But the figure who circumstances were, of course, completely different. But the figure who came to mind as I read about Weinreb was really Bernie Madoff.
Mm-hmm.
They were con men who used the same technique, which doesn't make Madoff perhaps as villainous as Weinreb, but Madoff too, his victims were mostly fellow Jews, and he used confidence in him as a man to be trusted, as a weapon. And he even would tell people that there was no more room on his list, which gave them even more incentive to want to be on it.
And yeah, to give it an air of exclusivity.
That's right. And Weinreb did the same thing. Now, in Weinreb's case, it was worse, because the victims of Bernie Madoff were basically greedy. They just wanted to make more money.
Right.
The victims of Weinreb wanted to stay alive. And to exploit that, of course, is much worse.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we should go back to the beginning, just on these three. We mentioned Weinreb. The Manchu / Japanese woman featured in the book is Yoshiko Kawashima, and then the Hitler's masseuse is a Estonian slash Finn. He's Estonian, but he's a Finnish national. At this point, his name is Felix Kirsten. But they all seem that the three of them, at least, all have something in common, or that they all sort of had, in their opinion or in their recollection, an idyllic childhood, or in their memories, their childhood is idyllic, that ends up being, it's a childhood or early adulthood that ends up being completely upended by war or revolution. And all three of them sort of experience living essentially as exiles. So they all outside of their country of birth, or, you know, where they grew up. So they all three have that in common together.
Yeah, I think that's right. I wouldn't call Kawashima Yoshiko, the Manchu princess, an exile necessarily, but they were all three were children of collapsed empires. Mm-hmm. And they grew up in the last years of empires where at least everything was seemed stable. Kawashima grew up as a Manchu princess in the last years of the Qing dynasty, and the Qing dynasty in China was, of course, a Manchu dynasty. Mm-hmm. Her family lost everything. And Kirsten grew up at the end of the Russian Empire, in Estonia, at least. Weinreb grew up at the end of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So, yes, and so nothing was stable anymore. And I think, although not technically perhaps exiles, all three felt displaced, didn't quite know where they belonged anymore. And the wartime circumstances, or the circumstances of in Kirsten's case, of the Nazi regime, the Third Reich, gave them an opportunity to reinvent themselves according to their imagination. Mm-hmm. And that is, I find that a fascinating aspect of human behavior.
Yeah, speaking on that theme of reinvention, you write in the book that these three thrive in World War II, but you could easily imagine them becoming social media avatars. Yes. That they're what they present to the world is really essentially like all social media websites is not true. It's fake.
That's you know? Right. Yeah. That's the one of the echoes today, and that we live in an age where inventing yourself, fantasizing about a different self and so on is basically actively encouraged by the opportunities of technology and social media.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go. I guess let's start with Kirsten first. And how did he end up becoming the personal masseuse to Heinrich Himmler?
Well, he had a talent, obviously, for massage. He moved to Germany. He was, although born in Estonia, he was basically a German-speaking person with German ancestry. So he was sent to Germany to train as a masseur. And according to him, but everything he wrote in his memoirs and so on is to be distrusted. But according to him, he met a Tibetan masseur in Berlin who taught him particular techniques. Now, I don't know if such a person really existed, but it is true that Berlin in the 1920s was, it was a time because of the defeat in World War I, because of poverty and violence and so on, times of deep uncertainty. And again, we can look at our own time as a parallel. People start to believe in anything, especially things that they feel can better their lives and so on. And so 1920s Berlin was full of seekers after spiritual answers to their lives, and all kinds of mumbo jumbo variations of vulgarized variations of Buddhism and so on were all popular. And Heinrich Himmler himself carried the Bhagavad Gita, the Hindu epic, in his pocket, and believed a lot of this stuff too.
Yes.
Kirsten became a popular masseur to people who were powerful and rich, industrialists, aristocrats, and so on, all over Europe. And Himmler heard about him, and Himmler had terrible stomach cramps, and there was no doctor that could relieve his pain. Kirsten, somehow, by manipulating him, could relieve it for short periods, not permanently, but for short periods. And so Himmler insisted that Kirsten become his personal masseur. Now, Kirsten always claimed that he was sort of forced into this, he had no choice, and so on. I don't think that's true for a moment. I think he lived very well. He was a great sort of bon vivant, had lots of girlfriends. He was a gourmand. He was a big man, and had a great life in Berlin before the Nazis came to power and after the Nazis came to power. I don't think it made much difference to him whether he took care of a pre-war industrialist or prince or aristocrat, or whether it was a Nazi party boss. They were powerful. And like certain kinds of hairdressers and so on who become confidants of powerful people, he became Himmler's confidant. He became closer to Himmler than many other much more powerful Nazis, because Himmler felt he could trust him in the same way that sort of very rich ladies sometimes trust their hairdresser.
Sure.
And so he was in an odd position, but he liked being in that position. I think he liked being a fixer and somebody who was important and knew important people. And
A macher. Yeah. Yeah. The one thing I know, going back to, you know, the Berlin in the 20s and just all the weird ideas that were floating around, the more I read about the Nazi inner circle, I'm always like fascinated about how strange a lot of these guys were. And I'm reading the book and I'm thinking to myself, like, you know, these guys, they all sound like a bunch of like new age California hippies, like these Nazis, like they're all like tree huggers who are into astrology and like Eastern mysticism and yoga and homeopathy and
well, some of them
and they're all on dope, and you know what I mean, like and Himmler maybe the strangest
the whole crew. Himmler was considered by other Nazis to be a little bit of a crank. Yeah. And there were also, of course, opportunistic Nazis who were only interested in power. Himmler did have a lot of very strange beliefs. So did Rudolf Hess, who was Hitler's deputy, who actually had terrible headaches. And he believed that having a magnet over his head could somehow pull the headaches out of his skull. Mm-hmm. There were other ideologues who were sort of nuts. But you can be a nut and also a completely ordinary person. I mean, if it hadn't been for the Third Reich and the Nazi movement, Himmler probably would have ended up as a minor high school teacher at best, or, you know, the manager of a provincial bank branch.
Sure.
So, but yes, well, Nazism itself is, of course, a load of mumbo jumbo and completely irrational.
Yeah. So the thing about Kirsten, I may be wrong here, I'm not sure how it worked, but I feel like Kirsten's sin, and apparently he might have done some good during the war. He might have actually saved some people from death at the hands of the Nazi regime. But I feel like, now correct me if I'm wrong, as a Finnish citizen, that he could have just, if he wanted to, if he was that uncomfortable with what the Nazis were doing, he could have left and just gone to Finland and sat it out. I mean, am I wrong about that? Or
no, I think he could, absolutely. I don't think he was uncomfortable particularly. Mm. That was claimed after the war, but I don't think it was true.
Right. So how much information about the final solution and the Holocaust, how much of that was Kirsten privy to?
Well, privy to probably quite a lot, because if you were close to Himmler and traveling through Lithuania and Poland and so on, you couldn't have avoided it. The question, of course, is how much did he want to know? And if you can know and not knowing and realizing and understanding, they're all slightly different things. It may not have been something he wanted to discuss. It may not have been something he wanted to hear too much about, but he certainly would have known a lot of the facts. There's absolutely no question. How much detail he knew, how much he saw, all that we don't know.
Right. But as I said, and of course he makes up a lot of these fantasias that, he saved the entire Dutch population from deportation to the East, that he saved the entire, France and Belgium and the Dutch and the Luxembourgers, I guess, from starvation, that there was a Nazi plan to starve the West, and he, did his magic on Himmler and got Himmler to change his mind, or got Himmler to change Hitler's mind, that sort of stuff. Which
that of course, is why that's the drama of the story he told.
Right.
What he claimed is that he made a deal with Himmler, and he could say, look, I can relieve your pain, but here's a list of people I want you to release from a camp, or here's what I want you to do. Now, you could see why Woody Harrelson would want to play Kirsten in a heroic version of this story, because it's a great story.
Yeah, from E. Howard Hunt to...
But probably not quite true.
Yeah, but... There is some circumstantial evidence that Kirsten actually may have done some good in that regard. He might have saved, not millions of people or maybe even thousands of people, but there is evidence that he did go out of his way, and maybe at his own peril, went out of his way to try to save people from their fate.
Yes, and again, because of his role as a fixer and a well-connected person and so on. And so when it started to become clear in sort of the last 2 years of the war that Germany was not going to win the war, people began to put out feelers to see if they could save themselves by making deals with the Allies. And Himmler was secretly open to such deals. And unlike Hitler, who was so fanatic that he would rather have died than protect any Jews, or let alone release them, Himmler was a more corrupt figure. I mean, he was open to that kind of wheeling and dealing. And so Kirsten, who also wanted to protect himself, of course, when he saw things were not going Germany's way, managed to give himself a role as an intermediary between neutral Sweden and Himmler. And so he acted as a kind of intermediary between the World Jewish Congress based in Stockholm and Himmler to see whether some kind of deal could be made where people would be released from some of the camps. And in exchange, Himmler might get preferential treatment from the Allies and so on. And now, all of this was pie in the sky. Himmler was never going to get that kind of treatment. But a certain number of Jews were indeed released as a consequence of these negotiations. Now, at the same time, the Swedes themselves were trying to negotiate these kind of deals. Of course, the main figure there was Folkert Bernadotte, who was the head of the Red Cross and later was assassinated in Israel by Stern Gang.
Stern Gang, yeah.
Before we get to the rest of this podcast, I wanted to let you know about two fantastic live podcasts Heartland produces every week. We'd love for you to join us every Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern, noon Central, live for our flagship In the Tank podcast. you can watch on the Stopping Socialism TV channel on YouTube, where you can participate in the show in the chat with other fans and also ask questions that we'll address on the air and put up on the screen. And every Friday, also at 1 p.m. Eastern and noon Central Time, you can go to Heartland's main YouTube channel. Just search for the Heartland Institute on YouTube for the new Climate Realism Show. Heartland's climate team of Anthony Watts, Sterling Burnett, and Linnea Lucan cover the crazy climate news of the week, debunk mainstream media myths about the so-called climate crisis, dig into energy policy, and much more. The show often features guests that include some of the leading climate scientists and energy policy experts anywhere in the world. There is no show like it. So become regular live viewers of both of these programs if you are interested in smart, lively, fun, and interactive conversations. We hope to see you there every Thursday and Friday afternoons at 1 p.m. Eastern and noon Central at the Stopping Socialism TV and the Heartland Institute channels on YouTube. Oh yeah, we're also on Rumble. See you there.
Let's move on a little bit because I know we don't have much more time, but we talked about VineRev for a bit, but maybe the most interesting, or at least as interesting, part of the story of his life, opposed to what you know he did during the war, was what happens to him after the war, where he becomes this sort of cause celeb.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about about that.
Immediately after the war, he was fingered by Jews who had been taken in by him as somebody who had collaborated with the Nazis and was responsible for some Jews probably not only being tortured but taken to their deaths, and so he was tried as a fraudster and a traitor, and spent some time in prison. Now, he would have become obscure if he hadn't become a spiritual cult leader. He became a Kabbalist. He set himself up as a sort of Kabbalistic wise man.
A guru, basically.
A guru.
Yeah.
For wealthy, mostly Gentile ladies. And he promised that he could tell them the secret of life because he could decode the Bible and that kind of thing. And wrote a memoir of his time in the war and saw himself as a victim of anti-Semites. And he saw himself as a kind of Dreyfus figure who had been persecuted by Gentiles who themselves had been much too close to the Nazis during the war and made him into a scapegoat. Then there was the first book written after the war specifically about the Holocaust in the Netherlands by a history teacher. And it was called The Downfall. And it was really, this was in the 60s. And it was the same time that student protest began, that it was the Vietnam War and so on. And this book had a chapter in which VineRev was indeed depicted as a kind of scapegoat for Gentile collaborators who wanted to wanted to blame a Jew for what had happened. And then it became not only a cause celebre, but he became a kind of heroic figure for the student and for the sort of student and youth protesters of the 60s, who saw him as somebody who had fooled the establishment, who was a sort of a non-violent resistor and so on and so forth. And he played up to this in the way that con mans do. They always know what people want to hear. And so then it really became a question of sort of the left adopting him as a kind of heroic Dreyfus-like figure, mm-hmm. Whereas conservatives were much more doubtful. And it became, and I remember this, I was still at school, but I remember when this was taking place. It was very heated debates in intellectual journals and so on, whether you were pro or anti-VineRev. Then there was a real attempt to get to the bottom of the whole thing. And a group of historians and legal scholars were asked to get to the to really find out what had really happened, what was the truth of the whole Weinreb saga. Mm. And after some years, they had to conclude that he was guilty.
Yeah.
And but the political role he played as a kind of hero to the left was indeed very interesting.
Yeah, and I guess maybe we should point out too, just just because I feel like dumping on the guy while we're here, but he not only was he an active collaborator, but you mentioned his lists, and they have lots of evidence and testimony that he was essentially sexually assaulting
yes,
many women that are, if he was putting people on the list, he said, okay, well, we got to make sure that I have to, you know, let me check out your wife or your daughter to make sure that she's healthy enough to be on the list, and then would, you know, subject them to this.
Probe them with weird injections and that kind
yes.
of thing. I mean, that was, of course, another one of his fantasies. I mean, he had a document which was completely fraudulent, that he'd studied medicine in Vienna and was a doctor, and clearly had strange sexual kinks, and again used a totally fake persona to assault these female victims.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Moving on again, I mean, there's much more to that Weinreb story. I mean, we're just basically scratching the surface with it. It's really an interesting story how he basically thought all this stuff up and conjured this big elaborate lie and managed to fool so many people for so long. I mean, you'll have to read the book, everybody. But in the interest of time, let's move on to the third person in the book, and that is Kawashima. And to me, I don't know if this is my male chauvinism showing through, but to me, she seemed, where the other two, whereas Weinreb's clearly a creep, and, you know, I think Kirsten could have made a decision to walk away that he didn't make. Kawashima seems more of a tragic figure.
Yes.
Or there was, obviously there's a lot of trauma in her childhood, sexual trauma, most likely, we don't know for sure, but most likely. But she's, her whole story and the course of her life just seems more, like I said, extremely tragic. Something about her that didn't seem to be, what's the word I'm looking for? She didn't seem to be malignant in the other two, or her crimes exactly were just sort of harmless, you know, in a way, or comparatively.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, again, so much is unclear. I mean, that's the other thing the three stories have in common, that we'll never know the exact truth about any of them. There are so mm-hmm. many lies told by them and by others and so on. I certainly agree that she was the most pathetic.
Yes, pathetic. That's the word I was looking
and,
for.
And that began, I think, before her stepfather possibly raped her when she was a teenager. The first thing that happened is that the family moved to what was once called Port Arthur and is now called Dalian in Manchuria, now northeastern China. Mm-hmm. And her father, who was a Manchu prince, had a friend who was a Japanese ultra-nationalist, who then later became Yoshiko's stepfather. But that happened in a very weird way, in that for whatever reason, her father, her real father, the Manchu prince, basically gave her as a child to his Japanese friend, as he put it, as a toy to raise in Japan, and to be handed over by your own father to another man as a kind of toy when you're a child, is already must be
Horrifying.
Deeply traumatic.
Yeah, sure.
So she grew up in Japan in this household of an ultra-nationalist whose ideals were similar to her father's, because there were Japanese ultra-nationalists, imperialists, who believed in Asia for the Asians, and they were fighting China, but not the Manchus. So Manchuria became part of the Japanese Empire, supposedly as an independent Manchu state. So Japanese nationalists promised the Manchus that they could have their own state and then eventually go back and rule China again. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so she grew up in that weird household of these ultra-nationalists in Japan. And her entire life was really a story of being passed from one man to another, but in a way in which it's not clear to what extent she was complicit, because she was a bit like, there's a famous play by Wedekind called Lulu, which is also an opera, in which there's a woman who has, young woman who first in Germany, and she ends up in London being killed by Jack the Ripper. And she goes from one man to the next. But all these men project their own fantasies on her as though she's a sort of blank screen. And Kawashima Yoshiko is a little bit like that. These men were all fantasized, had their own fantasies about her. And so she was a victim of men in one sense. In another way, like Lulu, she cooperated in all this and let herself become an object of fantasy, and she only rarely had affairs with men who were very powerful and rich. And so it's not entirely clear who's manipulating whom in her life, but that she was in some ways a tragic figure is undeniable.
Yeah, and she's sort of caught between these two worlds, her Manchu upbringing and Manchuria, and then obviously in Japan, and so she has this strange relationship with the two of them, and a strange relationship with Manchu culture and Japanese culture, and she's also something of a tomboy.
She dressed up as a man.
Right, yes. And again, not exclusively, but I mean,
but mainly, and again, we don't know exactly what the story was. Would she have been trans in our own time? Possibly. She herself said she was so badly treated by men that she couldn't trust them anymore, and she realized that living life as a man was a better option. We don't know, but you're quite right. The tragic quality that she had is not really knowing where she belonged.
Right.
Was she a woman? Was she a man? Was she a Japanese? Was she a Manchu? Was she Chinese? All that got mixed up in her head. And so she lent herself to Japanese propaganda, which was that here was a Manchu princess who was cooperating with the Japanese to restore Asia to the Asians, to kick out, you know, the Western imperialists, to restore the Manchus to their rightful place in China, and so on. And she was certainly manipulated to that end, but she was also a great manipulator herself.
Mm-hmm. And unlike the other two men, or Weinreb and Kirsten, in this book, who sort of escape justice for whatever theoretical crimes they were guilty of, or moral crimes, she then go on to live full lives, or she is actually executed by the Chinese after the war.
Under very strange circumstances. So Japan lost the war in China, the nationalists took over before they lost to the communists in the civil war, and she was arrested by the nationalists, and then was tried as a traitor. But what was very peculiar is that they used as evidence in her trial the fantasies that she herself had helped concoct. So mm-hmm. while she was still active during in the 30s and early 40s, a fictionalized, a kind of novel about her life was written. totally invented stories about all kinds of derring do that she supposedly engaged in, were published in the Japanese media and so on. I mean, so
propaganda films too, correct?
Propaganda films. So she'd already become a basic,
which are used as evidence against her.
Right, she became a legendary figure, and yeah, these legends, when then were then used in her trial as evidence against her, which of course is highly irregular.
Yeah, yeah. It's just there's something. Since you called her pitiful, and that was the word I'm looking for. That she just, her story seemed, or her story made me feel pity and sadness for her. Whereas Weinreb, you know, obviously contempt and anger.
I totally agree, but I try to keep my sense of condemnation and so on. I didn't want to overdo that, because I felt very strongly when you're writing about people like this, it is more interesting to try and understand them and see what made them tick and so on, than to use them as people to condemn.
Right, absolutely. And the reader can make those determinations themselves.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's not a fashionable view now. I mean, many novels and nonfiction books now are definitely written with the purpose of either to build people up as moral saints or to condemn them as villains. I that is not an approach I find interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of spoon feeding going on with, at least in the nonfiction.
And fiction, I think.
Yeah. Okay, well, I've already kept you 5 minutes longer than I said.
Well, that's okay.
So just one more question just to wrap it up before we go. And then, like I said, I'll let you get out of here. But the same sort of exit question I ask everybody that comes on the podcast. And that is, you know, what would you like the audience to get out of this book? Or I know we just talked about spoon feeding or whatever, and you're not interested in teaching. But if there's one thing you'd want a reader taking away from having read the book.
Well, I think three things. I think it's a deeper human understanding of people who are deeply flawed. A better understanding of certain aspects of World War II. I'm very, very chary of saying that lessons should be drawn, but I think it should be also read as a book that can comment a little bit on our own age of myth-making and self-reinvention and so on. But finally, I just want people to enjoy these three stories as stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the thing I was struck by is, well, as an American, is, you know, the concept or having being born in a country that was occupied during a war, and, you know, the whole collaboration versus resistance and meddling, like, it's something Americans, it's very alien to us. It's not mm-hmm. something we've ever had to, like, really grapple with in our country. You know, maybe after the Civil War, or something like that, but not really, because we weren't occupied really by foreign power.
Even in my mother's native country, Britain, there's much less of that than on the continent of Europe. I mean, it's a very basic divide, I think, countries that were occupied and countries that weren't. And
sure,
that, you know, gets has consequences, including the history of Britain and the EU. I mean, it's in some ways it's one of the things that explains possibly the sentiments behind Brexit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, like I said, it's just something we've never had to grapple with, and I don't think many Americans really understand how much that still sort of, even, you know, 70 years later at this point, how much that still takes place in in Europe, just the fallout, or I mean, even, you know, the fallout from the Great War itself, you know, and the breakup of the empires and all the thing. We really don't, I don't think we really appreciate how much, for lack of a better word, service that that takes up in the European imagination. So it was rather illuminating to see that in the book. And the book, again, for all you out there, it's a really fascinating story of these three people and three unique different circumstances. And the idea behind collaboration, you know, the difference between con man and hero is thinner than you would think. But anyway, it's just a fascinating, fascinating book. So I highly, highly recommend it for everybody out there. The name of the book, again, is The Collaborators. It's three stories of deception and survival in World War II. And the author is Mr. Ian Bruma. So Mr. Bruma, thank you so, so much again for coming on.
Thank you.
Before we go, just one more thing. Is there anything you want to plug while you're here, a website or appearances or
anything
you're working on or something like that?
My new book, Spinoza, Freedom's Messiah.
There you go, Spinoza, the other book we were supposed to talk about, which we didn't get a chance to. So, yeah, so go check out The Collaborators, and make sure you also check out Spinoza, too. I haven't read it yet, but I'm sure it's pretty great. Mr. Broom is a great writer. I have a few of his books beyond this one, and I have most of the Jewish Lives series, which the Spinoza book is a part of, and they're all pretty much universally fantastic, so make sure you check those out. And that's pretty much it. So again, if you like this podcast, please consider leaving us a 5-star review and sharing with your friends. And if you have any questions or comments or books you'd like to discuss with us on the podcast, you can reach out to me at tbenson@heartland.org. That's T-B-E-N-S-O-N at heartland.org. And for more information about the Heartland Institute, you can just go to heartland.org. And we do have our Twitter account for the podcast. You can check us out there. Again, if you have any questions, comments, or there's any books or anything you'd like to see on the podcast, check us out there. Our what is our Twitter handle? Twitter X, whatever. It's at Ill Books, at ILL Books. So make sure you check that out too. And that's again pretty much it. So thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you guys next time. Take care. Love you, Robbie. Love you, Mom. Bye bye.
When the world and I were young, just yesterday, life was such a simple game a child could play. It was easy then to tell right from wrong, easy then to tell weak from strong. When a man should stand and fight or just go along. But today there is no day or night, today there is dark or light, today there is no black or white, only shades of grey. I remember when the answer seemed so clear. We had never lived without or tasted fear. It was easy then to tell truth from lies, selling out from compromise. Who to love and who to hate, the foolish from the wise. But today there is